On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Nearly 10 months ago, Governor Evers earmarked $130 million in federal pandemic aid for workforce initiatives to help regions of the state with workforce challenges and connect unemployed or underemployed people with gainful employment. And today, our state has a record low unemployment rate. Wisconsin's Job Center portal has over 141,000 job listings. You can join in on our state workforce, what you see, 800-642-1234. Amy Pahachik is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Pahachik, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. As you look at these numbers, state unemployment rate hitting a record low, 2.8% in March, labor participation more than 66% above the national average there. How is the state's low unemployment rate affecting the work of your agency?
Yeah, well, we are really excited about having the record low unemployment rate in the state's history. That's great news for Wisconsin's economic recovery. And as you mentioned, Kate, we also have a record amount of people engaged in the workforce right now in our state. We have a record number of folks who are employed, and we are almost 4 percentage points higher than the national average for our labor force participation rate. So we are rolling right along. Now, of course, we know that there is a worker quantity shortage in the state of Wisconsin, like there is in the Midwest, and quite frankly, the entire nation and even globally. And that means that there are businesses with vacancies in every industry and occupation that they're having a hard time filling. So we have really been focusing our efforts on connecting those folks who still want to re-enter the workforce and have remaining barriers to those current opportunities and vacancies in our state. And we've got a lot of great strategies to do that. And clearly with some of these numbers, we can see that they're working.
And that's interesting there, because some of these workforce grant programs that initiatives have now closed, like the Workforce Innovation Grant Program. Have you measured and evaluated what these programs have done to address the worker shortage?
Yeah, so the Workforce Innovation Grant Program is part of Governor Evers' Workforce Solutions Initiative. That is that $130 million investment that you mentioned at the top of the hour. And the Workforce Innovation Grants, even though the second round of applications has closed, we are still evaluating those current applications and have an additional $40 million to disperse once we get through that second round. We have dispersed the original $60 million a few months ago, and those regional collaborations are well underway. We have already begun to see the results of not only that program, where we have childcare facilities going up in various locations, including Door County and Greene County. We have up in Eau Claire initiatives to keep health care workers within the rural communities. And so those folks have started those, but we are also seeing results from our Worker Advancement Initiative, which was our $20 million investment through the 11 workforce boards around the state. And there we have been able to place individuals who have had systemic long-term barriers in a variety of career opportunities, including manufacturing, IT, finance. And so we've been able to help hundreds of folks re-enter. We've got thousands that we are making contact with. So we're going to continue to monitor those, but so far we are seeing fantastic results.
And along those lines, you've had this worker connection program where you have these career navigators who work one-on-one with people to guide them to careers and work, matching their interests, their values. And these navigators have been active, I think, in 10 counties. What are your takeaways there?
Yeah, so we have got, again, the beginning of some fantastic results there. I went and visited one of the locations in Milwaukee just last week and got to hear about some really amazing success stories, including someone who had some transportation barriers, didn't have funding to reinstate their license, and our career navigators were able to connect that person with some community resources that were, you know, able to clear their violations, get their license reinstated, then place them with a job opportunity that they were now able to access because they had transportation. We were able to place another individual in the Milwaukee area into an IT training program and find that person an $8,000 grant through WIOA fundings to get them again into a high demand career sector that's really going to provide family supporting wages to that person who had been out of the job market for quite some time just due to lack of training. And so we again are already seeing the great results, and we know that these programs are going to continue to help people, especially now when there are so many opportunities available in the job market.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about workforce shortages, unemployment, underemployment with DWD Secretary Designee Amy Pahachik. You can join in on DWD 800-642-1234. Companies of all sizes, you know, as you talk about trying to get enough workers, they've had to pay higher wages and have had to also pay higher prices for the materials that they need to produce their goods and their services. So they then have to increase the cost of their products for consumers. And I'm wondering what concerns you about these inflationary pressures and the rising cost of doing business in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we certainly know that folks are feeling the pinch from inflation here in Wisconsin. And again, across the nation. And that's why it's just really important to point out that, you know, Governor Evers provided $480 million in tax relief for Wisconsin businesses throughout the pandemic. And that was to businesses and families impacted by the pandemic. The governor also signed one of the largest tax cuts. It was a bipartisan effort to deliver a 15% tax cut, one of the largest in state history. So we know that those measures by our governor are certainly helping. And of course, you are right that this is a great time to be a worker in our state. Rising competition between employers does mean better wages for our job seekers. And that, you know, quite frankly, is kind of a good thing right now, especially with inflation and just in terms of being able to have families that have family sustaining wages throughout the state is ultimately our goal.
Let's talk a bit here about technical education and the equipment. There, the department says $1 million in grants is available for high schools, and the deadline for the application, I think, is tomorrow. What are some barriers to providing educational access to the trades?
Yeah, so you're talking about the Wisconsin Fast Forward Technical Education Equipment Grants, and you're correct. We have an additional $1 million in grant funding that is available under those grants to school districts throughout the state. And we do anticipate announcing the next round of recipients next month. But meanwhile, we have already issued over $440,000 in those technical assistance grants. And what these grants do is they allow school districts to buy the most recent technology and equipment to help, you know, give exposure to students and train students in these cutting edge manufacturing processes and operations. So we know of the last round of 15 grant recipients, schools were able to buy things like 3D metal printers, robotic arms, water jet cutters, just really cool stuff. And so far, over 2,800 students have been able to interact with those equipment. And it just creates wonderful pathways and pipelines. We know that manufacturing is one of those industries that is definitely feeling the worker quantity shortage.
Yes.
And by providing students with these opportunities to experience the high-end technological day of manufacturing now, it's not typically the old dirty factories of what folks imagine in their head. These are really cool robotic, you know, opportunities and great careers that pay fantastic wages. So again, it's just about creating those experiences, those exposures, and giving these students hands-on training that could help them down that career pipeline.
Workforce Development Secretary Designee Amy Pahachik with us, has led the agency since January of last year. We're discussing workforce challenges, how its systems are being modernized. We're going there next. Hearing from you along the way, 800-642-1234. Back for more State Cap in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kedar Chirkent. We're in conversation with the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, DWD, that is in the throes of a major tech overhaul, modernization of its decades-old unemployment claims mainframe system. The agency entered into the $16.4 million contract about 7 months ago with a Madison-based software firm, and it's time to check in on how it's going with your DWD-related questions and experiences, 800-642-1234. Amy Bohachek is Secretary-Designee of DWD and with us for about nine more minutes. Well, let's talk about the evolution of the mainframe system and where you're at with it. What are the latest updates?
Yeah, so we're continuing to make fantastic progress, Kate. So if you recall, I think the last time I was on your show, we have inherited a system that is over 50 years old. And when I walked in the door, I was surprised to learn that when folks had to send in documentation to support their unemployment claim, they had to either fax it or mail it. So, our first efforts out the gate were to make sure we could do a claim portal upgrade, which now individuals can go on their smartphone or their laptop, take photos or upload any type of JPEG up to the system. We've got artificial intelligence on the back end that pulls that data right off, so it's very efficient. We now have secure messaging, text alerts. We've done our plain language overhaul, which is where our application was just full of jargon and legalese and very difficult to understand. Now it's rewritten in plain language so that regardless of someone's educational, regional, or cultural background, it is much easier to navigate, so less people are getting tripped up and caught in adjudication. And then since we've last spoken, Kate, we have moved off our antiquated call center. We are now into a modern cloud-based system that provides customer service access 24/7, 365. We are continuing our accessibility measures. Our virtual agents are fluent in both English and Spanish, and our online agents can also chat in Hmong, so we are proud of that. And as we continue to move away from the mainframe, we now have all of our groundwork IT systems architecture in place. We've got prototype screens. We are testing on some modules, and we're going to continue to incrementally move off module by module over the next few years. It's still going to be a four-year overhaul, but I am proud to say with all of these modernization efforts that we've already been able to put into place, the department is paying 84% of unemployment claims within 1 to 3 days.
Okay, and I just want to pause here because Flexion is a multi-year contract with options to leave the contract. Do you plan to stay with this contractor for additional years?
Yes, we are working very well with Flexion. We're moving right along. This is a large project. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint, but we have no intention at this time of moving away from Flexion, and we're going to continue to deliver on these great customer service improvements.
Let's look specifically at appeals, because you had faced a large backlog of unemployment appeals last fall. More than 12,500 claims were pending scheduling, and that number is down now to about 712 as of Friday. And you had hired contractors, you had hired administrative law judges. What is the status of these pending cases?
Yeah, so we pre-pandemic had 17 administrative law judges to hear the appeals. And of course, during the pandemic, when our claims, we had an avalanche of claims increased 200,000% overnight, we did also have that huge increase in appeals. So we bumped up to 72 administrative law judges, and we were able to work through those claims. We have been timely on those. So those 80-odd number that you just referenced are being scheduled and heard within the timeliness requirements of the Department of Labor.
Your ability to do this is through contractors to address pending cases? And I'm wondering about your approach to contractors, like, you know, the flexibility of adding and letting go contractors as needed to address case volumes versus having a more permanent staff.
So most of our contractors were in our call center operations before we had a fully modern call center. So we had staffed up to about 500 contractors. The majority of those were helping us answer phones. In terms of the administrative law judges, we actually borrowed ALJs from other administrative law positions throughout the enterprise. And we created project positions with some of those folks coming out of retirement who had previously been employed with us and came back to help us through that temporary, increase in cases. But we are very confident. We still remain at a higher staff level than pre-pandemic. So I think we've adjusted to what is an appropriate staff level going forward to continue to provide excellent and timely customer service. But we don't need the high levels of, folks that we needed at the time of the pandemic.
Okay. So, once these project appointments are over, do you anticipate keeping the administrative law judges renewing those contracts, or perhaps they would go back to their regularly scheduled positions somewhere else in state government?
Yeah, we have already begun the process of releasing them back to their full-time regular positions. And what we've actually found with some of these project positions is that it has really led to great succession planning for us. We have permanent regular judges that had, planned on retiring, are of retirement age. And these project positions give us a pool of well-trained and sort of vetted employees that we can then, seek to fill any vacancies if we, encounter them going forward. So it's actually worked out very, very well for the department.
We're talking with workforce development and employment system with Amy Pahacik. She's secretary designee of the Department of Workforce Development. You can join in 800-642-1234. Looking a little bit closer at the unemployment payments, nearly 7% of initial unemployment payments took more than 8 weeks as of February. Why? Well, that's much lower, of course, than earlier in the pandemic, but it is still above pre-pandemic levels. And what factors can cause initial unemployment payments to be delayed for months?
So if there are potential fraud benefits involved, if somebody we have to verify identities, as fraud cases went through the roof during the pandemic. So we have quite sophisticated individuals that are trying to cheat the system. So we have to, in some cases, go through extraordinary measures to ensure that people are who they say they are. And most of those, though, Kate, that are waiting and pending adjudication are because there is a dispute between what the employer is saying is the cause for separation and what the claimant is saying. So that involves a full investigation with interviews and speaking to other individuals at that place of employment and obtaining documentation. Often we are waiting for that documentation to be supplied to us from one of the parties. So some of those elements are a little bit out of our control. But yes, we continue to move forward with cases as quickly as we can when we have all of the information necessary.
Just a follow-up here. When you say fraud went through the roof in the pandemic, what do you mean by that?
It was a national epidemic. It was lots of bad actors during a time when new benefits were introduced nationally. Lots of folks were trying to defraud systems. So we were very proactive in Wisconsin. We put in many measures. We had fraud screenings through our partnership with Google. We had fraud screenings through other verification. And we were able to keep our fraud at a very, very low, I believe it was less than 2%. But in order to do that, to be good taxpayer stewards of everyone's money, we had to put those measures on the front end to weed out the bad actors.
I want to land here on reaching out to other states to find workers. The lobbying group Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce says Governor Evers should be spending more to promote Wisconsin and nearby states to boost our workforce. Is Wisconsin doing enough to advertise its job openings to people in neighboring states?
Yeah, so Kate, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, our sister agency, does have an entire marketing campaign really focused on attracting out-of-state workers. And so we are doing plenty. We've got fantastic opportunities here in apprenticeship and attracting folks to our schools here in the state and keeping them here. Of course, there's always room to do more, so we're always looking to continue those efforts. But I have to just caution, Wisconsin is not alone in our worker quantity shortage. Every state is facing this. It's a national epidemic. So there are not just thousands and thousands of workers sitting around in Illinois and Minnesota without opportunity. So we really have to be competitive on a variety of different fronts to attract workers here to our state.
Secretary Pahacik, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Amy Pahacik is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Ahead this hour, a state capitol report continues with State Senator Dale Coinga, one of 30 departing lawmakers from the state legislature. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is a state capitol report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have State Senator Dale Coinga, who announced recently he will not seek re-election. He's one of 30 departing lawmakers, the Associated Press offering that latest count. Coinga referenced politically tumultuous events, and we take stock of his 12 years in the legislature and talk conservative tax policy. He's a CPA, chairs the Senate's Financial Institutions and Revenue Committee. You can join in on Wisconsin's fiscal future and tax policy points, 800-642-1234. Dale Coinga is a Republican representing the 5th District of Brookfield, portions of Milwaukee and its western suburbs. State Senator Coinga, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, what changed your mind? What made you decide to not run again for re-election?
Yeah, if you asked me in February, I would say I'm definitely running. And then there was a series of maps, and one of those maps pushed me outside of the district and into a district that did not have an election. So, being a Christian and saying, okay, all things have a reason for this, we started planning family vacations and started having some private sector job talks. And essentially what happened was then the maps reversed, we were back in, and went to go put it back in gear again. And it was like, you know what, it's been 12 years. They call it public service. And I've always believed in being a citizen legislator. I like the state Senate because it's the last level of office you could be in where you're not a full-time politician. So I've been managing a very, very busy, robust Army career, a very busy, robust private sector career, and most importantly, 4 kids that are 8th grade, 6th grade, 4th grade, and 2nd grade. So 12 years in service, and I don't want to be a full-time politician, so I decided, you know what, let's walk away from it and let someone else serve.
You served 8 years in the Assembly, now serving a 4-year term in the Senate. What do you see as the differences in serving in the two chambers?
Yeah, I mean, I prefer the Senate, which is one of the reasons I would love to do another term if I did not have all these other priorities. But they're different bodies. And it's funny how, if you go back to the nation's founding, how that's how it was structured, where the one house was meant to be more reactive and was meant to be faster acting, right? The House, and here we call it the Assembly, and the Senate is intended to be more deliberative and slower. And so, you know, the Assembly in Wisconsin, especially, I think it's most states, is really driven by leadership. It's funny because when you have more people in the chamber, it's almost easier for the leaders to lead in a certain direction because, you know, Ron and Voss can lose a dozen votes. And it's like, okay, all right, fine, you're not going to vote with me. You know, but in the Senate, the majorities are much smaller. So guys like Fitzgerald and Lemahue, they need to be much more judicious. They need to be slower. They need to listen to all the voices for a longer period of time. And so it's just a slower chamber. So I appreciate both experiences, but I personally like the Senate. And, you also have more leverage because Wisconsin has 99 state reps and 33 senators, so you have a little bit more sway.
You mentioned Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, and I'm wondering what your relationship has been like with the Senate leader and how those relations have been, because in the Assembly, some lawmakers have really gone forward and stood by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and some have not.
Well, yeah, I have a great relationship with Senator LeMahieu, and I was also sorry to see Senator Fitzgerald go. I think they're just guys who, in a pure leadership perspective, they don't push a lot of their own ideas. They're trying to look at the larger caucus and the larger platform. So I think Senator LeMahieu has been great to work with. So, yeah.
What do you make of the sheer number of lawmakers leaving? 17 Republicans, 13 Democrats. You know, this is historically high since the 40s and 50s. Why do you think so many lawmakers are leaving?
Well, yeah, it is very high. You know, whenever you have redistricting, that's definitely a driver, because when you're at this level of office, oftentimes the way you win is by knocking on doors. And so there's a little bank of trust there. Like, if you knocked on doors for your last election, you know, that does give you some tailwind to carry you through in future elections. So there is that contemplation, like, oh, my district looks different, I got a lot more work to do. Two is, I think it's going to be a big, big year for Republicans. I think if you look at the national polls, if you listen to people, the inflation issues are just hurting families. I mean, I know our family, we have six. I keep saying, you know, it's 8% inflation. But when you have a family of six, it feels like, and especially when you're like to out to eat, I mean, it feels like 8% inflation times six mouths to feed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, what the Coinga family feels on this is what the Wisconsin families feel. So I think that Democrats in particular are probably looking at that and say, oh, it's going to be a tough year for my party. Do I really want to do this? And just generally, I think that there's a, you know, it was a historic turnaround in 2010. A lot of those folks have run its course. So, but at the end of the day, I think a lot of people have their own personal reasons. I mean, people are getting older. They want to retire. I think my situation is probably unique. Mostly people either retire, like from retire, or they kind of move up the ladder. My situation is unique where I'm just like, you know what, I'm 43 years old, and I don't want this to be my full-time career. I got other careers I want to put myself into. So I'm not climbing the ladder. I'm not retiring across all efforts. I'm just simply saying, yeah, it's a service job, and I want to do something else in my time.
Let me reintroduce you here for a moment, talking with State Senator Dale Coinga, Republican representing portions of Milwaukee and western suburbs, chairs the Senate's Financial Institutions and Revenue Committee. After 12 years in state politics, announced he is resigning. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Let's focus here a moment on redistricting, because, you know, you mentioned tailwinds. Republicans have a huge advantage, heading into the next 10 years with redistricting. Your district alone, the new maps, up 7.2 points compared to the previous map for Republicans. The corresponding assembly district is up 15.9 Republican. So, you know, what do you make of those huge changes for Republicans heading into this next decade of politics?
Well, I mean, you mentioned, I don't know what assembly district you're mentioning of 15.9, but if you look at like
District 13,
and then if you look at District 14, I mean, that goes the other direction. So if you look at the district, and you point out the Republican district, that has gone up a lot. It's more Republican, but then the 14th district, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think it goes almost the exact opposite way, right? So the 5th Senate district, the one I represent, it was a plus 9 Joe Biden district. I believe under the new maps, it's a district that Trump lost by 600 votes in the last election. So this district is still fairly competitive, although Trump, I don't think, is a great factor for the Republican Party in this part of the state. But I think that there's the maps are what the maps are. I mean, I think that the process was, as always, a difficult process. There's a lot of court involvement. But at the end of the day, Wisconsin has a demographic reality, and that is that there's a heavy concentration of left-to-center votes in Madison, Milwaukee, and the rest of the state's pretty red. So I think you're seeing that, and, I was not very involved with the map drawing process. I got to see some maps and got to vote up or down. But I think that the other reforms that should come alongside this, I've been the biggest voice and lead author of ranked choice voting. That's probably a whole other show. But I think the primary process on both sides of the political spectrum is broken, and it's giving us bad choices that don't represent the middle of our state or the middle of our country. So I think ranked choice voting makes tremendous sense. I also wanted to have a public hearing on different alternatives to the current redistricting process. I don't know if I've seen an example that works perfectly, but, open to ideas. So, I think that there's definitely, issues with redistricting in every state. You definitely see it in Illinois and New York as well. But overall, I think the bigger problem with Democrats is going to be the inflationary economic environment, not the maps.
You mentioned former President Trump's impact on your part of the state being less so, which makes me wonder how you feel about the Gabelman investigation into the 2020 election. Where do you stand on it?
Well, that Gabelman investigation, it was an assembly-led effort.
Yes.
So that was, and I'm in the Senate. So, we didn't vote on that. In fact, I actually voted to do an audit of that investigation with some, like two of my Republican colleagues, I think, joined me on that, Senator Coles and Senator, who else was it? Anyway, so three of us voted for an audit of that. But I think it's run its course. I mean, I like what we did, and that was the Legislative Audit Bureau. We had the Legislative Audit Bureau do some nonpartisan work, and they came back with some great recommendations on what we could do to improve our election process. Unfortunately, the governor vetoed those. I think you'll see those bills in the future again. But I think the Gabelman investigation's run its course, and I think it should be moved along.
How do you think lawmakers could work more productively, debate really difficult cultural flashpoint issues, and get work done together? I'm thinking about gun violence and religious freedom, racial issues, abortion.
Yeah, and going back real quick, Senator Bonner joined Senator Coles and myself on that audit.
Okay.
I had moments. I think people know this, and this is what I'm talking about, ranked choice voting, and getting a larger segment of people to do some reasonable things in the chamber, because the incentives are not to compromise under the current system. So, you talk about, one day we had one of my colleagues was doing a resolution for Rush Limbaugh. And so then the Democrats lost their mind. And then on the same day, they were trying to do a resolution for Black History Month, which had some individuals in there that the Republicans didn't like. So they were losing their mind. And it's like this chamber that could be solving so many issues is to, like, having these cultural wars as opposed to solving the problems that are before us. And there's all sorts of problems before us. I mean, the closure of schools has been absolutely disastrous for our kids. And, they're having these debates while our schools are closed. So, yeah, very disappointed on many different fronts. I mean, you brought up gun issues. I mean, I'm a Second Amendment guy. I like to hunt. I'm a member of the U.S. military. I appreciate the Second Amendment and will defend the Second Amendment. But at the same time, because I appreciate the Second Amendment so much, I've introduced bills to say, hey, I don't think fugitives in Wisconsin should be able to buy a weapon. Hey, I think if you are a domestic violence perpetrator, that you should not be able to buy a weapon, just like it's in federal law. I said, simply, let's replicate a state law what's in federal law. And I couldn't even get hearings on those bills. I mean, and that's ridiculous. So, once again, going back to the problem is, we need a system that changes the incentives of lawmakers, because most of the lawmakers are not bad people. And most of the lawmakers across both sides are very good people, but wrong incentives. And the wrong incentives, which is, what's your next election? Well, your next election is a primary. So I'm not going to support anything on restraining the Second Amendment. Like, even if it's for fugitives and for domestic violence perpetrators, I can't do that. So, it's frustrating. But I think at the end of the day, too, we did find a lot of compromise. I mean, most bills do pass with bipartisan support. They don't get a lot of news and a lot of press, but there's better goodwill. There's more being done across party lines than you would think. And in particular, in my case, I got a great relationship with the Milwaukee mayor and Milwaukee County executive. My colleagues. So, I mean, things got done, things were getting done, there'll be more be done in the future.
Let's pause right there with Republican State Senator Dale Cuenga of Brookfield stays with us as we look next at Wisconsin fiscal management, state budgeting, and tax policy amid the pandemic. He's not seeking re-election this fall, but we're seeking your questions, 800-642-1234. There's more State Cap in a moment with State Senator Cuenga here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with State Senator Dale Cuenga about our state's fiscal position, his views now on tax policy. Bit of history: over a century ago, Wisconsin was the first state to tax income. And fast forward to the state budget Governor Evers signed last year, passed by Republicans, that cut state income taxes by $2 billion. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. State Senator Dale Cuenga with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Joan is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Joan. Go ahead. Hi, Joan. Are you there?
I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Good morning. For your guest, I have a question. I had heard the comment earlier about how closing schools had been a disaster. I'd like to know how the guest would have handled it. I think the governor did a fine job of doing what he could to protect us as citizens and our younger citizens in school. Thank you.
Joan, well, yeah, Joan, thank you. State Senator Cuenga, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the facts are already showing. The test results are plummeting. The emotional and the societal impacts of closing schools from a community aspect. I mean, I think most Americans would argue, looking at hindsight, is, you know, we should not have closed the schools for as long as we did. In fact, I actually...
And when you say close the schools, you mean doing virtual learning at home. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I mean, and there's some, I mean, for high school, virtual learning is more effective than it is for first or second grade. But that's where, you know, to me, the priority of education raises to a level that it was worth some public health risk to actually keep our schools open. Because now on the flip side, you're going to see other, you know, second, third order effects of closing those schools that are also related to health. When you look at suicide rates, when you look at addiction rates. And so, you know, I value education so much is that I think having a physical school open and having that presence in community is very important. And you can't replicate presence, a person's presence in your life and a community in an online community, especially at that age group. So, you know, I believe the school should have been opened earlier and there should have been more in-person instruction.
Even prior to vaccines being widely available.
Yeah, I mean, it's a school by district by school district basis. But yeah, generally speaking, I mean, now granted, we know more about it than we do. We know more about everything today than we did back then. But, you know, all along this journey, it's been a very, very, very minimal risk to big children. Yes, the adults. So, there's things that we did and could have done. But, you know, once again, I'm not saying zero risk. But to me, the priority of educating our kids rises to the level where we as adults should have taken more risk to prioritize in-person instruction.
Joan, thanks for the call. Let's move on to tax policy. You have urged moving to a flat tax rate around 4%. Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center says a flat tax rate would largely provide relief for higher income households. Do you think that's a fair assessment of the potential benefits?
Well, yeah, I mean, Wisconsin has a very progressive income tax code. And so you can't get around from a pure numbers perspective that if someone makes $10,000, they're not paying Wisconsin income taxes. But if someone's making $100,000, a family's making $100,000, then they're paying more income taxes. So even if you have a flat tax, just the way math works is that higher earning individuals, higher earning families are going to be paying more taxes. And particularly, especially for large families, I mean, you have to earn more to provide for a family. And so you're in Wisconsin, you're not only paying a higher tax rate against the base income you're making for your family, but it's also going against more income. So, yeah, I've always been an advocate, and we've made some good progress over the 12 years to lower taxes. I did a lot of that by getting rid of loopholes and special tax credits that special interests had. 17 of those are gone today, while at the same time collapsing those tax brackets. But the vast, vast, vast majority of our tax cuts, and the vast majority of the tax cut for a flatter tax, is for the middle class.
I want to look more closely at the surplus before we're out of time. We had Revenue Secretary Peter Barca, who said on our program that the state is expected to end the two-year budget with a $3.8 billion surplus. We've got a rainy day fund at its highest point ever. What should the state do fiscally in light of the flush coffers, in light of the surplus?
Well, I think there's a lot of priorities the state should have going into the next budget. In no particular order, is some of that should be tax relief. I mean, you're looking at record inflation, families and seniors, people on fixed incomes and people starting off their careers. Everyone's feeling this inflation. And so what Wisconsin can do is continue to lower our tax burden to ease the pain of that inflation.
Does that mean a tax refund?
No, I'm not a fan of tax refunds. I think if you're going to do tax relief, you just simply lower the rates and do it prospectively. I think the mechanics and going backwards of tax refunds does not make sense. Number two is, I think state, you know, the, a lot of priorities that the state has, our teachers need raises, and our teachers' raises should be at least inflationary. So if you're looking at inflation right now, once again, the 8% range, like, we got to make sure that we're putting sufficient money in education to make sure that our educators are getting paid for their work, and that they need more money to get paid more for their work. So that's another priority. You look at priorities as far as the state's infrastructure. So there's definitely going to be a long list. The good news is we have the cash. The revenue numbers are coming in strong, in part because of inflation. But, yeah, there should be more money invested in education. There should be more tax relief. So I think that you'll see whoever's in charge go the route with, hopefully, on both those fronts.
Less than a minute left here, but what about the legislature's freeze on in-state undergraduate tuition for the UW system that's been in place since 2013? Should it be lifted?
Well, it has been lifted. Yeah, it has been lifted now. So now the University of Wisconsin system has more flexibilities to raise their tuition. That happened last budget.
And because, you know, going back, that was one of your high points, looking for extra money in the UW system. How do you feel about that?
I was one of the advocates that I was the guy who found the $1 billion at UW, along with some of my CPA colleagues, that led to that tuition freeze. But I also felt like that had run its course, and the University of Wisconsin tuition amounts are fairly reasonable. And to a certain extent, those that are going to our state's universities who will benefit from that education, I felt like that we could give that back to UW system to make some adjustments with some compromises. So I was an advocate for putting that in place, and I was an advocate for giving more flexibility because, you know, the way things work is the policy that you advocate for yesterday is not always the right policy for today or tomorrow, depending on the circumstances. So hopefully University of Wisconsin will be responsible with that, because we got to make sure that our education is affordable for middle-class families, that there's plenty of financial aid available for those that are below middle class.
And Senator Coinga, we need to leave it there. Thank you for joining us. State Senator Dale Coinga, representing Milwaukee and Western Suburbs.